Nyman is up late on the East Coast. It's midnight back there. Henry, thanks for staying up late. This is kind of a breaking story. It's a revolution in criminal investigation, and it opens up a whole new paradigm, doesn't it? This is a new deal.
Yes, it does, and that's why I thought it'd be a good idea to kind of give an update. Both on the expansion of the technology and a little bit more detail on the earlier case. It kind of got into the news because of the identification of the Golden State Killer, and turns out to be Joseph DeAngelo, and that was really done using a sample that had been collected back in the mid-70s, and they used a genealogy site called GEDmatch to find relatives of that DNA, and then they did investigation of people that would fit his description, and started with about 100, and narrowed it down to about 5, and ended up zeroing in on Joseph DeAngelo, because he really was their best match in what was known about him and what was actually known about the killer. And then they did get a sample from him, from discarded DNA, and found a match. And they just got a court order to actually get another sample directly from him. And I'm sure that will also show that it's a match. And part of the reason it's made so much news is because this is very old, very cold and old case. I mean, he committed his crimes back in the mid-70s and mid-80s.
Yeah.
And they had these samples. I mean, he did a lot of crimes. I mean, I think he killed over a dozen people.
So they were collecting samples back then, Henry? Excuse me. They were collecting samples back then, and they had them all dried up and all that, whatever, in envelopes or plastic since then?
Right. Well, it turns out, I mean, like I said, there's been a couple updates. NPR did a show this afternoon on their Science Friday show, and they did cover this, and they were using this as an introduction to talk about the personal DNA services. They're basically called DTC, or direct-to-consumer DNA kits, and the issue about the databases and the privacy, and I can get into that a little bit, because it is very far-reaching. It goes well beyond forensics as far as the DNA and matches and medical markers and relationships, and using them for people who are adopted to find their parents, or to have paternity issues where it turns out you're who you thought was your father is not really your biological father. And all these are identified very, very easily on these types
Let me just run down that little cul-de-sac. Are people finding out that their parents really aren't their parents, both parents, in other words? Maybe mom or dad was cheating somehow, and they're finding out that... This can be bad news for people. This could be tough.
Right. Well, I mean, there are a lot of implications. In case of sperm donors, where sperm donors were anonymous, the children can actually figure out who the sperm donor was. By doing that. Paternity and maternity can can figure out whether it's your real mother or father. And these are pretty easy to figure out. Again, it's an example where everybody doesn't have to be tested. The relationships show up. So, I mean, if you take one of these tests, it's as simple as spitting in a tube, or a couple of them as a cheek swab, but you basically drop it in the mailbox. And the testing is kind of revolutionary. These types of tests, they generate what's called SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, And essentially, they take your DNA and run it, put it on a chip that has like 600,000 markers on it. And based upon the sequences that are on the chips, it determines for each of these markers, there's basically two choices. And it says what your combinations are. I mean, you could have two copies of one or two copies of the other or a mixture, one of each. And it'll score that for each of those 600,000 markers. And so there's a lot of data there, and it's known where each of those markers are on each of the chromosomes, and most of them have some type of you know, research information as far as whether they're markers of susceptibilities to various diseases, or whether they tend to run in one genetic group or another genetic group, and you're really put up against a large database that and these are big numbers now. That's part of the reason this is all so doable.
Is the database getting bigger all the time?
Yeah, they're right now, Ancestry has about 10 million samples, and 23andMe has about 5 million samples. And the GEDmatch that was used to identify the Golden State Killer, they've got just under 1 million. And there's a little difference between the databases. The first two larger databases, those are generated by those two companies. So in both of those cases, they use saliva and you send it in, and they're somewhat restrictive. They don't really cross over. So if you submit a sample to Ancestry DNA, they'll show you your DNA relative to their 10 million in their database, but they really won't tell you anything about your relationship to people that are in 23andMe's database. And it's the same thing for 23andMe. So if you want to, you know, get access to both of those, you really have to send in a sample to each company. And so you would have results for 15 million people if you send in a sample to each
one. All right,
one.
I understand.
And GEDmatch, though, actually doesn't do the testing, but they allow you to add your DNA file. So you don't really give them a biological sample. You give them the results from 23andMe or from Ancestry or from a number of other sites, companies. One's MyHeritage, the other's Family Tree DNA, and all four of those sites will generate your DNA database, and it will allow you to download that. So you'll actually have a file on your computer that basically has all of your results, and you can, that's your file of your DNA, and you can do with that, you know, whatever you want. And one of the things you can do is you can upload that DNA to a site like GEDmatch. And so GEDmatch, although they don't generate the data, they accept the data from all four of those services. So that way you can cross over. If you have 23andMe, you can find your relatives in Ancestry without actually submitting a sample to Ancestry, but you're really only looking at a subset. You're only looking at people that took the Ancestry test and then uploaded their data to GEDmatch. And GEDmatch apparently has close to 1 million, so not as big as either of the other two, but it does have samples from both of them, and so you can find your relatives there, and it's more interactive for actually doing the analysis.
Okay, can I ask a question here, please?
Sure.
All right, I just raised the specter of people finding out that mom and dad really, it's not my dad who's my dad, it was somebody else. My dad and my mom were together, but she cheated, right. Whatever. This kind of thing is going on, that's what you said. What are the other downsides on this, all this genetic stuff? I mean, that's a pretty big shocker for a lot of people. gosh, Mom, Dad isn't my dad.
Well, there's several kind of shockers or of interest. I mean, most of the things are more on the good side. I mean, the bad side would be if you're an anonymous donor to a sperm bank and you basically, you know, did that either for the money or just to, you know, basically help, you know, if you're male, then you're helping out women that need a sperm donor to conceive. And you did it when you know, anonymously, and then you get an email or a phone call from one of your offspring that basically found out who their father was on the basis of if you had taken the test. Or just like the Golden State Killer, you don't really have to submit your DNA, but they could conceivably identify the donor on the basis of relatives of the donor. So the relatives had taken the test, they would see that they're, you know, a first cousin of this person, and it gets real easy to identify when the relationships are real close. You know, if you're a first cousin, then of this person, if the person used their name or if the person's, you know, willing to respond to an email request, you can pretty quickly figure out, you know, why that person's a first cousin by identifying, you know, who the, you know, if a sperm donor was your father, then you can figure out who your father is. So that would be a downside on that. Those are probably the bigger ones where the biology doesn't match
and all of a sudden the mailman turns out to be your dad.
Right.
Not a lot of fun.
And on the positive side, you know, there are people that were adopted and they don't know anything about their family history. They really don't know who their biological parents are, and they can identify the biological parents, not just to identify them, but to potentially know a little bit more about their health risks and family history on the health side, although they can get, you know, a lot of that information right off of their own DNA. And so they can get predispositions based upon the markers that they have, but not all the diseases have known markers. And so they can get a family history for health purposes. Those are some of the genealogical. And then the other is just to find relatives that you didn't know exist. And find out exactly how you're related, and that's one of the other pluses.
Give me an example. Give me one example. All right, I go through this process.
I can give you a personal example.
Yeah, please.
A personal example was there was one person who actually took the ancestry test, and he was listed as a third cousin to my wife, and he actually did upload his data to GEDmatch, and I had my information there as well as my wife as well as our kids, and you know, I mentioned once before that my wife and I are actually distant cousins, you know, not very close at all.
Yeah.
As it turns out, we can use the database to actually identify people that are related to both of us, and people that are basically related to both of us and more related to each of us than we are to each other. And it turns out that my wife's third cousin would actually falls into that category, because we kind of exchanged emails and determined that my wife's grandfather and his grandfather were brothers, and this is pretty funny. There were clues based on what the brother's name was. It was a long name that both families ended up shortening, and so the shorter version was very similar between her third cousin and her maternal side, and so you could kind of tell from that, but the fact that the DNA said that he was her third cousin would match that type of association. But it turns out that in his case, I'm just as closely related to him as my wife's sister is. So there's a relationship there where I'm significantly more closely related to him than.
All right, pretty weird. You could spend a lot of time on this.
And then on top of that, our son is actually closer to my wife's third cousin than my wife is to her third cousin, because he actually has most of the markers in common with between my wife and her third cousin, but he also has markers that I have in common with my wife's third cousin. So he ends up being closer to my wife's third cousin than my wife actually is, and significantly closer than my wife's sister is. So okay. you can come up with those types of relationships and actually find real people. And because he was actually researching his the family name that my wife's grandfather actually immigrated to the U.S. In 1905, but you can get a lot of information. His immigration papers are actually public records, and they're available, and that helps clear up some. There's some confusion when you go back that far, because his immigration paper says that he was from Russia, and he's actually got a stamp on there that says Nicholas II, Emperor of all the Russias, on his paper. So, you know, he was clearly from Russia. But it turns out that the town that he was born in is called Klitz. And Klitz really no longer is in Russia. So, I mean, back in 1905, it was Russia. But after the 1917 revolution, that the Klitz area actually became Belarus. So he's from a town that's in Belarus now, but all of his immigration papers and all of his census papers all have his country of origin as being Russia. So you can go through these documents and clear up those types of things. And it turns out that her third cousin's grandfather was also from Russia. So it would, and he came, you know, in the same time frame back before the revolution.
Right.
Anyway.
Okay.
So anyway, that's an example on how you can find relatives. I've read stories going the other way where people realize that, their father or relatives of their father are not relatives of them. You know, that they should be pretty close to both their father, and even if the father hadn't been tested, his first cousin might have been tested, and then they see that the first cousin doesn't show up on their DNA relatives.
Henry, are these going to lead to legal problems?
Well, I don't know.
I think so. I think so.
It kind of depends. You know,
if I found out that my father wasn't really my father, that could open up a lot of potential.
Right. And I don't know how much legal. They just might be more emotional type issues. I mean, people find this out once they're, you know, they're adults already, so they're not
Well, I know there's probably a clock running on all this.
Be alive anymore.
That's the point.
It's
a strange thing. Okay. All right. So back to the criminal hunt.
Right. So the criminal hunt is the success on identifying the Golden State Killer now has authorities in California looking to do the same thing with the Zodiac Killer. And the Zodiac Killer was actually also in Northern California, mm-hmm. but he was even earlier. He was in the late 60s. And there's some new methodologies that allow separation of DNA from the glue on the backs of envelopes. And one of the things the Zodiac Killer did is he taunted the police and sent about 20 letters to the police.
And they're pulling the glue apart and getting DNA off the glue.
Right, right. So they want to take the DNA they can get off the backs of the envelopes that he sealed and then see if they can use that DNA to identify relatives and essentially do the same thing.
Can they take that DNA and clone a human being yet? Do you see that coming?
Probably not from the backs of envelopes, but clone a human being from DNA.
Yeah, a good clean DNA sample. It's doable, isn't it?
I mean, there's Dolly the sheep, but there's been some other advances fairly recently, and I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. It was either human or primate that they could basically do some cloning. I mean, they didn't go all the way and make a person, but they went
not
far
that we
enough
know
to
of.
Cell embryo. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they went far enough that it wasn't.
They were on the way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been that hard to keep developing.
I got
that,
it. All right, hold on a minute, Henry. This is wild, wild stuff. Okay, back in a minute with Dr. Henry Nyman. Okay, and we're back. Very interesting world of personal DNA and what it can do. Wow. So this whole idea of third cousins once removed and co-joined at the hip, or whatever. I don't know, Henry. It's Greek to me. I was told once that if you went into any urban area in this country and picked randomly any 10, quote, normal, socially active, productive members of society, 10, in any city, you would find somewhere in that 10 a link to somebody you knew or had some kind of a connection to in life. I'm not talking DNA. I'm talking about social things here. But take any random 10 people and you'd find some kind of a link amongst that group. That, to me, was very interesting. Now, with this DNA thing, it's getting really strange.
Well, the DNA thing, they kind of covered this a little bit on the Science Friday this afternoon. They were talking about
What was their approach to it? How did they handle it?
Well, they started with the Golden State Killer, and they kind of gave a little background on how he was identified by going into a genealogical database. And then they brought up the issue of, how protected is that data, and easy is it for third parties to have it, and
pretty easy.
What kind of issues there are with privacy? And they drew some parallels with, like Facebook and advertisers knowing where you go on the internet and who your friends are and things along those lines. But then they noted that the DNA is kind of a step beyond that, because with the Facebook and your profile as to what sites you visit and who your friends are things that you kind of develop and they can change. But the DNA is kind of what you're born with, and that kind of pretty much defines you. So you can't really, if somebody has your DNA, you can't really change your DNA or, change what websites you go to or basically get rid of your cookies or anything. You basically, that's pretty much a definition of who you are. And they noted that there were, some safeguards with regard to insurance companies. They can't really use your DNA profile to determine eligibility for insurance.
Let's watch
our
and see.
Rates. And there are a couple limitations. Mm. But one thing that surprised me is that life insurance companies can still use DNA data. So that was a little bit surprising to me. I thought that would be covered also. And so the guests they had on were more on the legal side and privacy issues. And they talked about those and then talked about the databases and what happens to your data after it's collected and it's at the database, and what kind of protections there were. And they did note that the 23andMe and Ancestry were kind of closed off type of databases. If you have your data on one, you can't really get to the other one. But the sites like GEDmatch really kind of opened that up, and that was more of an open DNA database, because their people are actually uploading their data and they're doing these types of genealogical searches. And they mentioned some of the things I mentioned with what people use them for with respect to paternity, maternity type things, identifying donors and those types of issues. And they're all the same thing, saying this is kind of a new novel approach, and it's a new area, but it's expanding pretty dramatically. And the other show that was on today was 2020, that was on tonight. And they did an hour show on Golden State Killer, and they gave a little bit more detail on exactly how the technology was used. And from what they said tonight, it sounded like they actually didn't use 23andMe or Ancestry. They it turns out that one of the forensic scientists back in the 70s. He would always collect two specimens from each crime scene. In these cases, these were rape kits, and it turns out that one of the early cases from the killer, he collected the samples, and so one of the samples had never been opened since the 70s. So it was sealed, and that was the sample that they used. Uh-huh. And it sounds like, now they said that the samples they had weren't sufficient quantity to submit it to like 23andMe or Ancestry. And I'm a little skeptical about that. I have a feeling that a rape kit, the amount of DNA in a rape kit is pretty similar. similar to the amount of DNA you'd have in a saliva sample. But they kind of downplayed that as actually being able to take that DNA and submit it to one of the larger companies. But it sounded like they went ahead and generated their own raw DNA file using one of their labs. So they took the DNA, extracted the DNA, and I had mentioned, you know, when we first talked about this phenomenon, that just about any forensic lab can extract DNA, and then to get the data on these tips, the tips are commercially available. So it sounds like they took the DNA from the unopened rape kit and then extracted it and put it on one of the commercial chips. So then they had a raw DNA file. So they actually had the file, and then they registered it at GEDmatch using a fake ID, and they uploaded the DNA. The DNA results, not the DNA itself, but the file of the results from applying to the DNA to the chip. They uploaded that to GEDmatch, and they identified relatives, and that their best matches were basically third and fourth cousins. So they took the third and fourth cousins that showed up on GEDmatch, and then they in many cases, those samples will actually have a genealogical tree associated with it. In other cases, they could contact those people and work on getting together genealogical trees. And from those trees, they identified about 100 possible subjects that were related to the crime scene sample, and then they used demographic data on age and gender and where those people would have been in the 70s, and they started with 100 and they whittled that down to 5, and then from those 5, Joseph D'Angelo was one of the 5, and he was the most obvious one. Mm-hmm. And they basically did surveillance on him and got a hold of a discarded DNA sample. And then they took the DNA from whatever it was. They didn't say whether it was a soda can or a cigarette or a coffee cup, but in any event, they got DNA, and then they tested that DNA against the crime scene sample, and they got a match and made the arrest. And then, as I mentioned more recently, they got a court order to actually formally get a sample directly from him. They'll run.
So this is setting legal precedent now. In California.
Yeah. Now, as it turns out, they used a public database, so I don't think that there's an issue with respect to how they identified him, because they didn't identify him directly from the database. I mean, he did not have a sample in the database. They identified really third and fourth cousins of him, and then they did classic kind of police gumshoe type things of running down, who these people were that matched and who their other relatives. So that's why I say it expands, that not only would they start with third and fourth cousins, but then from those third and fourth cousins, they could identify relatives of the third and fourth cousins and generate a genealogical map of people that also had not given any DNA samples. Uh-huh. And so most of these people that they had on their list, their 100 people, were relatives of the DNA matches, but most of them had not submitted a DNA sample either. And that's part of what what came up on the Science Friday, they were saying, well, you know, these databases are already getting to be fairly large, and that they're really kind of getting very close to an all-in situation.
Uh-huh.
Where that,
well, tune in 2 or 3 years, and they'll have 100 million in some of these.
Well, it's not that they have to get the 100 million that they've got all these connections, so that they can take the 15 million. And you know, just to reiterate, they did not use the 10 million that were in Ancestry or the 5 million that were in 23andMe. They only used the 1 million that were at GEDmatch, a little under a million. So you know, if they wanted to take a step further, where they could basically get a court order that would say, they've got the DNA from the crime scene, they've got some cousins using a small database, then they could conceivably take a court order and serve Ancestry and 23andMe and say, well, we've got a raw DNA file. We want to upload the raw. We want you to take the raw DNA file and and tell us who the relatives are in your database. And so they would have, you know, on paper they would have 15 times as many samples that would be tested. And you know, they could conceivably have come up with a first or second cousin. If they had a first or second cousin, running down that person would be much easier than a third or fourth cousin. And they would just have 15 times as many samples to identify relatives in, and that would be used for creating these trees. So they'd go through the same process, but it would be much easier because they would start with their initial screening would be 15 times as much. And that's what I'm saying. If you take that number, that you've got 15 million people, and that each of the people that were tested, you know, they've got, you know, 10, 50 relatives that you could basically put on that tree, then you would have, a lot of people that would be linked to the DNA samples. Mm-hmm. And most of those people linked to the DNA samples would be linked through, the genetics, the known relationships, not through the DNA itself.
Got it.
And then if you want to take that a step further, you could take that tree and take the people on the tree and ask them for a sample and then compare their sample with the samples that you already did have, and that would confirm that the people that were listed on the tree really are DNA relatives, and you could identify people that were actually closer if you had more samples. So you could run along with hard data by just looking at the DNA results, as opposed to having a list of 100 people and trying to figure out where they were 40 years ago and did they have the same physical characteristics of the killer. So the DNA could take you much further down the road, and you could do that if you actually were able to access the existing cases, the existing 15 million people that have already been tested. And that's just in the two larger services. There's probably several additional million in the other two that I mentioned. There's even smaller ones, but all of those are growing. So the number that are tested may not get to 100 million, but it could easily double in several years. And then if you had 30 million people, and then you had the ones that are related on a tree, it would be all in. I mean, you basically would have essentially everybody in the United States would be linked either to the DNA or through the tree that could be confirmed with DNA. That's why I say it's very powerful, and then if you have a sample, you just have to kind of put a marker on the map, if you will. This marker is third and fourth cousins to these people, and these are the relatives of these people, and your target is among those relatives, and you can run through the map and zero in. So that's why the technology is so powerful, and why they may be able to do, people like the Zodiac Killer.
I think that the door is wide open. What did these programs wind up with as the potential for the growth area? Where do they say this could go?
Or did they? Like I said, they used the all-in term as far as who's covered. And they said that, it's at a level now where they said very soon, and I think that it could be beyond very soon. It could be right now.
Right now.
It's just a matter of of accessing. And like I said, for something like rape kits, I think rape kits have a fairly high concentration of DNA. And so I'm a little skeptical that you couldn't literally do it today. And
why couldn't you? Of course, I agree.
Well, their argument was that both 23andMe and Ancestry have a minimum amount of DNA that they want to extract before they'll actually put it on a chip and run it. And I know that part is true. That basically, I've been through the procedure. If you send in your sample, they generally start by taking part of the sample and do the extraction. And if you don't have enough DNA, they'll tell you that they're going to try again and they'll take more of your sample. But if your sample is too dilute for, there weren't enough cells in there initially, they won't run it. They'll say there wasn't enough, and the existing protocol that I know of, they would ask you for another sample, so they would try it one more time, and then if that didn't have enough DNA, they would tell you, we'll give you a refund, and we couldn't get enough DNA. So it's conceivable that if your crime scene sample does not have enough DNA and you submitted that to them, and they couldn't extract enough DNA to get to their requirement for putting it on the chip, they wouldn't put it on the chip, and you basically wouldn't get a result. But my sense is that, because there aren't that many cells in saliva, and a couple of these services actually just use a cheek swab, and they tell you to go on both cheeks and go around and around a few times, and they kind of gobble up cells as they're doing that, but it's still a relatively small number of cells, and with a sperm sample, I would think there's a lot of DNA there, and so in a rape kit, I think you would have a reasonable chance. And so under those circumstances, assuming that your crime scene sample does have sufficient DNA, you could pretty much test these databases just
you
as
could
I
wrap it up
previously.
You could do it one day. Easy.
Right. Well, you could send one sample of 23andMe. You could send another sample to...
Yeah, but there's going to be a national computer DNA database and interactive, real-time, instant analysis for the cops before you know it, if they don't already have plans to do this.
Well, I don't know. There was some skepticism on that. The idea was creating a DNA. I mean, there was one possibility was just, collect a sample at birth and create
they used to do footprints on babies, remember?
And the sense then was that there'd be significant resistance to doing that.
Well,
and,
good luck resisting.
And that's what I had said in the past, that, as far as getting this data, you were talking about the government getting the data, et cetera. I mean, the amount of DNA required to do these tests is very, very tiny. And you know, any clinical sample would have, you know, any blood sample or, well, I don't know, urine sample might be pushing up, but a saliva sample or a blood sample will will have sufficient number of
cells. Well, there you go. Just a blood DNA. Test, right? Any blood test could be used without your knowledge. It's so easy. Crazy. Henry, this is very interesting.
Right, right. The mechanics would be easy. I'm not sure that, you know, getting the samples and actually, you know, giving them to somebody would certainly violate, you know, existing laws.
Violate? Do you think they care about laws anymore? Haven't you? You know what kind of surveilling is going on now. We have no rights left. Rights to privacy.
I got a sense that part would be a significant hurdle. The other part, where people are actually doing home testing, that, you know, obviously...
Well, time will tell. Time will tell.
Already.
You're right on top of it. Thank you for sharing all this. We'll keep watching it. Let me know next time when there's something to report. We'll do it.
Okay. I think there's a reasonable chance they'll identify the Zodiac. And if they do identify the Zodiac, those two together will kind of propel this.
You betcha.
Very, very dramatically.
I agree. All right.
So I'll keep you posted.
Thank you, Henry. Get some sleep. Happens. Thanks for staying up. All right. Henry Nyman. Okay. We will be back Sunday night with our best of for the week, and then Monday. Have a good weekend. Take care. Thanks for being here. You matter. And don't forget that.